You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Eddie Bates. I love sharing missionary stories with you to help you connect with our missionaries, understand how the Lord is using them to bring the good news of Jesus to people around the world. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, go to our website, kfuo.org, and look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section there. And today we head to a part of the world where we haven't seen or haven't had a lot of conversations with missionaries in the past. Today we're heading to Spain. Well, in studio with me today, the Reverend David Warner. He and his wife, Shelley, are serving the Lord as career missionaries in Spain. Pastor Warner, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you, Andy.
Glad to have you in studio and to hear your story of serving as missionaries in Spain. Let's start with the story of how the Warners first started considering this vocation of missionaries. When did you first start thinking about becoming missionaries?
We considered whether we wanted to serve on the mission field when we were at seminary. My wife and I lived in Spain in the 1990s when I was serving in the Marine Corps. And we had an interest, but at that time, we didn't pursue that. We came out of seminary, took a call in Montana. But then really following the 2013 mandate from the Synod and Convention for the Office of International Mission to expand, double their number of missionaries, because of the Spanish language skills that I had, my name was submitted, and Pastor Ted Cray from the Latin American, Caribbean, and Spain region contacted me.
And how much of Spanish culture, and you mentioned language skills already you had acquired during your previous career, how much did you learn about the culture when you lived there? And was there anything about it that was that drew you to more to consider this opportunity?
Well, Spain's a great place to live. I mean, it's a beautiful place, has a lot of attractive things, from beaches to history to architecture, good food. So, I mean, it's a fun place to live. We really enjoyed Spain. You know, I wasn't thinking about being a missionary when I was serving there in the Marine Corps, but, you know, as a lifelong LCMS member, you're there in Spain and you're seeing the influence of the Catholic Church. And so it does, you're thinking all the time, because it is it's a very different place in that regard. And so, you know, all of that, I guess, made us predisposed to the possibility.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the church. You mentioned, obviously, the Roman Catholic Church, very prevalent in Spain. What about the history of Lutherans in Spain? What can you share with us about that?
Well, as we celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, we're trying to emphasize quite a bit just to help educate people in Spain that Lutherans were there. Now, Lutherans in name, perhaps not, but by the 1530s, shortly after the Reformation started in the rest of Europe, even though Spain was very, very Roman Catholic, the teachings of Luther came into Spain through the church and had quite an influence. And there were a number of monasteries where Luther's teachings really took hold, including one in Sevilla, where we live, another one in Valladolid, where almost essentially the entire population of the monastery was convinced by the Reformation teaching. And so there was the beginning of a Lutheran Reformation in Spain in the 1530s, early 1540s. But then the successor, Charles V, was a Holy Roman Emperor. He was also Charles II, King of Spain. And he never really went after the Reformation, the Lutherans, very specifically. But his son was not the Holy Roman Emperor, but he was the King of Spain, Felipe, and he eradicated the Lutherans. The Spanish Inquisition, which spent more of their time focused on Jews or on Muslims and eradicating that from Spain, also turned on those monasteries where Lutheranism was taking hold. And so the Lutherans that were in Spain were either arrested or fled, many of whom fled. One in particular who's important, or two, Cassiodoro de Reina, then as he was actually being pursued by agents of the crown all around Europe for decades, also did the first translation of the entire Bible into Spanish, much as Luther did into German. And then also a man named Valera, who edited that, which gets us the Reina Valera Bible. It's the predominant Spanish language Bible in the non-Roman Catholic world, and a very important translation. And so they fled. Others stayed and were arrested. Probably about two dozen Lutherans or Lutheran sympathizers were burned to the stake. Many, many more were died in prison, in the Inquisition prisons. And so by the 1550s, the Reformation was eradicated in Spain.
So where does that bring us then today in terms of opportunities for mission and the Lord's work in Spain?
Well, four centuries of Roman Catholicism as the not just the favored, but rather the really only option through the various kings and of Spain through the centuries, but then also under the Franco dictatorship in the 20th century, he was very, very much allied with the Roman Catholic Church. Vatican II and kind of the opening of the Catholic Church in the 1960s wasn't well received in Spain because they liked the old Catholic way in Spain. Franco did, the dictator did. Then Franco died in 1975, and Spain made a transition, really a remarkable transition, from a military dictatorship to a Western democracy. Many good things, including religious freedom for the first time. In the 1980s, religious freedom was declared in Spain, but many not so good things. Abortion becomes legal in Spain in the 1980s as well, for two examples. But then it was only in the 1980s that open mission work could be done in Spain. And so that's from there. It was in 2000 that a specifically Lutheran mission was started in Spain.
When you share with local residents that you're a Lutheran pastor, what response do you get? Do they look at you like you're an alien? What's a Lutheran? Are they very familiar with what a Lutheran is?
Some are, not many. And the typical Spaniard who is culturally Catholic, at least, they will say that they're a Catholic. They will lump all non-Catholic churches under the label evangelical. So Pentecostal churches, of which there are many, very small little Pentecostal churches, kind of old line liberal denominations, which there's a couple of those that exist and kind of had an uneasy truce with Franco during the dictatorship years. The Anglican Church is present there, but then also Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, who are quite prevalent in Spain and growing. All of those to the average, those are all evangelicals. So then there's a lot of work to do, saying, well, we're something different. And really, there aren't a lot. The Anglicans are fairly liturgical. The Spanish Episcopal Church is fairly liturgical. Outside of that, most of the other churches in Spain are non-liturgical. I mean, they're Pentecostal, or very different approach to all things about the church. And so for most Spaniards, they don't understand that. They see worship they don't understand, and so it's a very strange thing to them. For us, then, it's trying to distinguish what's the same and what's different and get the opportunity. But maybe the most frequent thing that you'll get when they find out that you're a Lutheran or an evangelical, they'll say, well, you don't believe in Mary. Well, of course we believe in Mary. She's the mother of our Lord, but they have a different perspective, and so that's a very common it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's a chance to start a conversation, but there's also a presupposition there and kind of an understanding that, you know, if for this individual person, Marian piety, a devotion to Mary is the center or very important in their faith, and that's quite common in Spain, then they've got this prejudice against anything not, because I don't want to talk to you about religion because you don't believe in Mary. Well, we don't believe the same things about Mary, but so we try to be very careful to honor Mary as we all should. She's the mother of our Lord. Her example of faith is a phenomenal example of faith. But it's a narrow, it's kind of a tightrope to walk there, because they've got a predisposition against that.
So it's, how do you approach that conversation? What are some examples of conversations where that was perhaps the starting point?
It's interesting. I haven't had, I won't say none, but I haven't had a lot of those conversations. You know, you need to have some other way to have a reason to have a relationship with that person, because mm-hmm. that conversation is not likely to go very far. Mission work in Spain is very slow, because even if you're only Roman Catholic in name, you were baptized, maybe you did First Communion, but you never go to Mass. Even in that case, and that's the vast majority of Spaniards, is that they're Catholic, but they don't practice at all. Still, leaving that and entering into another confession, very, very difficult thing to do. Our inroads with Spaniards has been much more with Spaniards who studied the scripture for one reason or another deeply, and there's our opportunity with those people. The challenge that gives us is that we have these individuals, and they're very spread out, but what we haven't done is have a local congregation that just is reaching out to the people in their neighborhood. And that's going to be two very different things. It's one thing to have somebody that's kind of naturally interested in theology and does a lot of reading. And those conversations very often go very well, because they can see that there's a clarity and an integrity with Scripture in what we're saying and teaching that they don't see in other church bodies. But for somebody who's less interested in that, how do we then locally, you know, make that connection? And it's going to be slow. We can't kid ourselves that this is going to be something that goes really fast, because it's just a very difficult thing. And I don't think we figured out how is that going to go. But one thing is to establish locations. The mission up to now has not established locations, and so we haven't had a visible presence in communities. And we just need to start with that, so that there's that place for people to come if they have questions and see that we're a church that does church in an outward fashion, not unlike mm-hmm. what they're used to seeing, which, Lord willing, gives us the opportunity to then get to the Word and get to the difference in terms of the teaching.
Do you speak about the Reformation in conversations like that?
A little bit. Try not to focus too much on the Inquisition, because some Spaniards will say that they're Catholic and yet be very negative toward their own church. And so they are like, well, of course, the church is terrible. But yes, I'm Catholic. And so it's a very convoluted thing. Really try to get to into the Word, into the kind of the specifics of the gospel, because there's a lot of dead end roads to go down mm-hmm. because of the preconceptions and the misconceptions.
Let's talk about life in Spain and adjusting to that. Now, you had mentioned you had already lived in Spain for some time. Tell me about what's life like in Sevilla now.
It's enjoyable in many ways, although it was surprisingly difficult to make the adjustment. I mean, when we lived there in the 90s, we lived for a short time in the community, but for the majority of the time on the Spanish naval base in American housing. And so we visited things. We went all over Spain and other places in Europe, and were quite a bit out into the community, but we could always retreat to America, essentially. So that's one difference. But a really, what was very difficult for us in making the transition is that because the church was, there was not a missionary on the ground when we went in 2015. There was one Spanish pastor, and there's members scattered all over, and so worship was very infrequent. And so that lack of a church life that we're very used to, and I would have intellectually been, of course, I'm dependent on my weekly connection to the life of the church, but now much more in my gut. Yeah, I really, I understand. I really need this. So that was a big deal. And then just, it's one thing to be, essentially a tourist, and I have some Spanish ability and they appreciate that, but I'm not trying to live in it. To know now I'm here. We need to live in this language. And that's just an experience you have to go through. You have to live through that. And so all of that, it was challenging, but good. And it's mm-hmm. It's a beautiful place. There's a lot of great things in Spain. So,
now, how long have you been in Sevilla?
For 2 years.
2 years. And feeling somewhat settled in yet?
I think so. I think that we've, you know, we've still got a ways to go in terms of really being, okay, this is just where mm-hmm. we are. But I think we kind of turned a corner maybe in the last 6 months. One of the huge benefits for us at the end of 2015, we had been there for 8 or 9 months by ourselves. There's one pastor in the community, but he's got a full-time job and a family. He did dedicate a lot of time to us, but he's not there for us in that sense. And the pastor Adam Lehman, his wife Christine, and their kids came in December of 2015. And that's been, that was a huge turning point for us because now we've got a partner and this other family. And there's a wonderful family. By the mysterious will of God, also a former Marine. So we're only taking former Marines on the field there.
And how close are they? Are they in Sevilla as well?
They're in Sevilla as well. And we won't both stay in the same community indefinitely, but really the focus right now, we've rented a property in Sevilla. He's actually this week trying to push the stone over the hill finally and actually get electricity. It's the last piece we need to be able to use this facility for worship. Bureaucracy and the way things are done in Spain is very, very frustrating. But we are focusing there until we get that up and going, and then we'll likely then split and be in different locations and start working in another location as well. More. We travel and serve in those locations, but we live in Sevilla.
Living in Sevilla, I have to ask about the arts and cuisine and all those fine things of
you shouldn't ask. You should come.
I would be more than happy to.
You got room.
I think we need to do a live broadcast.
Absolutely,
from Sevilla.
Absolutely.
I think so.
No, it is a phenomenal place. Sevilla is an ancient city. There are there are pre-Roman ruins under the city. There, you know, Roman ruins and everything in between, you know, monumental architecture, a really interesting culture, a lot of beauty. There's still two significant monuments that are from the Moorish culture, that is the Muslim kingdom that ruled much of Spain for 700 years, and then Christian, when the Christian reconquest and the building on top of that. The kind of the stereotypical what the Western world or what Americans know of Spain in terms of tourism really is Southern Spain, Sevilla, the flamenco dancing, the bullfighting. While the bullfighting is a dying art or a dying sport, I don't know what you want to call it. It's slowly dying. It's not nearly as important as it used to be, but it's still there and it's still a big part of the culture. The winding medieval streets. I mean, the whole thing. It's fantastic.
What have you learned about the cuisine in the area, and has that been a way to connect with others?
Well, Spaniards do almost all their socializing, except with like close family. They socialize in restaurants and bars, and a bar in Spain is not a place to go and drink. A bar in Spain is a place to go have a drink so you can talk to people, and the whole family goes to the bar. There's no. It's just a very different. I talk about going to bars, and I'm like, people are probably thinking, why is Pastor spending so much time in bars? Because that's what you do, mm-hmm. and it's just not the same. It's really quite one of the more positive things about their culture is that socialization, and by and large, Spaniards are interested and interested in talking to Americans and learning about that. They are quite. In generally, they're fairly guarded about speaking about spiritual things. Getting to any kind of depth takes a lot of time, but to talk to people and to get to know people, they're very open.
Hmm. What has been your favorite food when it comes to life in Spain today?
Wow, my favorite food.
Is it because there are too many?
It's interesting. Spanish cuisine is not haute cuisine. It's generally speaking fairly simple food, but it's very good. It's not healthy. It's quite fatty. I mean, fried fish, a mixed fried fish platter, and it'll be fantastic. And the fish is very fresh, but most typically they're going to batter fry it, which tastes great. But and the paella is wonderful, which is a rice dish and with saffron and meat and vegetable mixed in. There's jamón serrano, which is a smoked ham, very, very good. It's more of it's not a meal, but it's a tapa, a little bit of food with your drink. I don't know. I mean, I like the rice pudding. I like it all. Chorizo, the sausage. It's
with the significant Catholic influence, Roman Catholic influence in culture there, things like seasons of the church year and seasons of the church year, does that significantly affect life and the culture in Spain? You know, for example, we're in the season of Lent here, and here in the United States, American Roman Catholics, many don't eat meat on Fridays as part of their religious practices. What's life like in Spain when it comes to cultural influences from the Roman Church?
70% of Spaniards still confess to be Roman Catholic, which is down from 90-some 30 years ago. But 70% still say they're Roman Catholic, but only 10 or 15% are what we would call active in the church, say maybe they go to Mass once a month. So the proportion of the population that's actually active in the church is quite low, 10 to 15%. So most Spaniards don't practice, wouldn't do any of that. However, their calendar is the church calendar. I mean, the Holy Week, Semana Santa leading into Easter, schools are closed. Everyone's off. It's either just vacation or they take part in the processions. And there's kind of two religious pieties in Spain. There's the official church, the mass that's going on, and the regular parish life. And then there's the processions and the extra festivals and the pilgrimages, and far more people participate in the street Catholicism than they do for example, during Holy Week, all of the processions that they do all during the week from Palm Sunday all the way through Easter, these processions will lead back into a church, and there'll be a mass following the procession, and there'll be giant crowds in the street for the procession, but nobody. Very few people are there for the mass because that's not they're doing it in the street, and so that it's there, it's all around you, but not too many. There's a limit to how it affects their life, and many people then don't do anything with it. I mean, many Spaniards, they're not interested. It's a very secular country, even though it looks very Christian.
So if you were to eat meat on Friday, or can you not even, if you go to a restaurant on Friday?
No, there's no
meat.
Tourism is king in Spain. It's very, very important to their economy. They're not going to put any restrictions in the restaurants. There may be individual Spaniards who are choosing not to, but I would say you would notice that more here in the United States, in a community that is, got a significant Catholic. I mean, where we served in Sydney, Montana, we would go to the fish fry on Fridays at the Catholic Church. It was great fish.
Sure. Same here in St. Louis area. Too.
Right. And that's not a,
not a thing.
It's there. There's things going on, but it's not very significant.
What is, just about a minute left, what's the outlook for your work and the work of other missionaries in Spain and the future of Lutherans in Spain?
Well, because we have the gospel, the outlook is eternally good, fantastic. I think we need to be realistic because it's slow. It's going to be slow. But it is also a great opportunity. And we've gone, in the 2 years we've been there, we have one Spanish pastor, we had two men studying to be pastors, and they're still in process. But we've added two more men who've come into the church who both have potential and background that lends to it and are now interested in working toward becoming pastors. The members we have are very well taught. They understand why they're Lutherans and they're interested in growing a church there. And we have The clarity of our teaching. I mean, I've had many conversations with Spaniards that may, in the end, want nothing to do with us, but they will say that the clarity of your teaching stands out. That we, you know, we're biblical. It's there. They can see it. They may choose not to agree with it, but they can see that. And so all of those things are you know, we can see that the pure gospel in God's word is going to do its work. And so the opportunity to be there is fantastic. And what God's going to numerically achieve, we don't know, but it's a wonderful thing.
My guest today, the Reverend David Warner, serving the Lord in Spain. Pastor Warner, thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Planned Parenthood commissioned a so-called study that made outlandish claims. It said if all women of childbearing age used Planned Parenthood's contraception, the abortion rate would drop by over 60% and taxpayers would save $12 billion. Talk about a Pollyanna science. All women of childbearing age will never use contraception. Plus, there's a large body of scientific data that shows heavy promotion of contraception can be ineffective at preventing unexpected pregnancies and lowering the rate of abortion. In some cases, it made the situation worse. If Planned Parenthood wants to shoot for the stars, they should consider abstinence until marriage. It's clear just how desperate Planned Parenthood is to legitimize their existence and use of your tax dollars.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Thirsty throats need a well of water that runs deep and never runs dry. This week on the Lutheran Hour, Pastor Gregory Seltz tells how thirsty souls receive the living water only Christ can supply. And a listener wonders if all religions are really the same. That's all this week on the Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO.
You listen to Worldwide KFUO often. You try not to miss your favorite program because you benefit from the gospel message proclaimed. But have you shared KFUO with your friends and family? It's easy to do. Just like us on Facebook at facebook.com/KFUO radio and share us. You can email your friends or family an audio link of one of your favorite programs and let them hear for themselves. Share KFUO and help spread the gospel to the world. That's the good news in the Messenger of Good News. Worldwide, KFUO.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Faith and Family.
What does it mean to be financially fit? Joining me in studio today, Ostolio Gomez. He's a director of worker resources at Concordia Plan Services here in St. Louis. Hey, Ostolio, welcome to Faith and Family.
Good morning.
Good to have you in studio here today. Looking forward to learning how to be financially fit. Also joining us in studio today, Mark Borchardt. He's the Director of Retirement Products and Services at Concordia Plan Services. Mark, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you. Good morning.
I think I'm ready to retire. Can you help me out with that?
Start now. Get ready by starting now.
No, I think I'm ready to retire now.
Are you sure?
No, probably not. I was hoping he would say yes.
I don't know anything about your situation, so I can't tell you whether or not You're ready.
That sounds like you practiced that a little bit. Well, I am excited to learn about what you all do with Concordia Plan Services, learn about your work, and also the how you help our church workers prepare for retirement and just being financially fit. And I think this is something that we all can benefit, not just church workers, but all can benefit from in terms of being financially fit. Eustolio, share with us a little bit about the work that you do with Concordia Plan Services.
I'd be happy to, Andy. My responsibilities are to provide the touches that we must provide for our workers to help them to look at their personal finances in mm-hmm. a healthy way. Now, not everyone is healthy, but they can address these issues in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And that is to really look at who it is and how it's being provided for you. And so stewardship is always a critical aspect of what we address when we talk with folks. And simply put, the stewardship is, you know, can be defined as the daily joyful activity of a child of God. And so it's not necessarily compartmentalized. Sometimes we tend to think that that we address these issues in very narrow bands, but really it's about the way of life. And so when we address it from that perspective, mm-hmm. every aspect, whether it's your physicality, your spirituality, your emotional well-being, all of those aspects and a variety of others actually impact how you view that whole issue of handling money.
Something tells me that this has something to do with the wellness wheel.
It does. It does. It's a great tool because it really helps us to see that in baptism, we are new creatures of God. Mm-hmm. Created by Christ and his sacrifice. And so with that in mind, and in that proper relationship that only he can establish, we have spiritual well-being. Mm-hmm. We have spiritual well-being inside of that wheel. Really, you know, all those, the six aspects are there. And so, as I mentioned before, it could be spiritual, it could be emotional, relational, mm-hmm. intellectual, vocational, physical and financial. All those aspects interact, have an impact on how we deal with this whole issue of personal finance. Personal finance, in many ways, is one of those issues that really takes the forefront because everyone is impacted by that. Mm-hmm. Everyone looks at that from a different perspective. And the fact is that there, if we look at that issue of just money, it's one of the greatest stressors in our personal life and in our relational life. Mm-hmm. And the way I like to talk about that is that when a couple gets married, here are two different cultures coming together who have never talked about money, all of a sudden being thrown together. The next morning, you're both responsible for the same checkbook. And so it's one of those things that come between people. Folks go on with their life without talking about it, making financial decisions on their own as if they're in a silo, never communicating with the other person also responsible for that money. That's where the stress comes mm-hmm. because one person may be thinking, why is he spending that money? The other person may be thinking, why isn't she spending that money? So it's as simple as that.
How we regard money it really comes from our family of origin, doesn't
correct.
It? Yeah,
correct.
It comes from, it may or may not be like, you know, in the same manner that our parents regarded money. We may learn from mistakes or poor choices, but that family of origin really does shape how we view money and, well in any kind of possession.
Yeah, it molds your perspective in a positive or a negative way. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a few that I speak with that are extremely healthy. And it is such a joy to talk with them about that. They're not afraid to talk about the issues that are involved there. It doesn't reflect anything about themselves. It's this gift that God has given to them mm-hmm. that they manage together. When you see that, when you talk about that, it's really, really quite enjoyable. And then there are the majority that over time begin to develop a relationship that kind of hurdles that. Mm-hmm. But that's what they've done. Many hurdle that and kind of push that financial discussion over to the side. When the healthy thing is to just talk about it, mm-hmm. because after all, it's just money. When people think about that, you think about that, the money is nothing but a means of exchange. Mm-hmm. You know, in agrarian society, I grew wheat, you grew cows, mm-hmm. I wanted fajitas, you wanted tortillas, we would swap. Now what we do is you have a service, I have money, mm-hmm. and we exchange that.
So time, in a sense, becomes a commodity
exactly.
as well.
Exactly.
Because of money. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk more about this and learn what you share when providing this education for individuals. Before we get to that, Mark, let's learn a little bit about your work with Concordia Plan Services.
Sure. So working with the retirement plans, our goal ultimately is for workers to be ready for retirement when it's time. And in particular, to have the income necessary for them to go into retirement. It's one of the main things that the benefits provide, right? Mm-hmm. The Concordia Retirement Plan provides a basic monthly benefit for a person in retirement. And then the Concordia Retirement Savings Plan is a 403B where a person provides some of their own money along the way, mm-hmm. and that then helps them to be more ready for retirement when the time comes. And that part of it where the person needs to be saving on their own, you know, first, you need to be financially fit mm-hmm. before you're ready to save for retirement. So it really all works together when it comes to getting ready and preparing for retirement. You really have to have your finances in order, mm-hmm. You know, get your debt down, get your income, basically your inflows and your outflows in a good situation so that you can then be putting money aside for retirement. And that's you know, where Ostolio's education comes in a lot. And what we're trying to develop more of, too, is going through those basics first, because that's what's got to happen. We hear a lot of times from people that, well, I just can't save for retirement. I don't have the income to save for retirement. And in most cases, it's just simply not true mm-hmm. because they haven't gotten the basics right first. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the basics.
Okay.
Where do we begin, Ostolio?
Well, the way we go about making these kinds of sessions happen, there are a variety of ways. We have one-on-one sessions, and generally a worker will call and set up an appointment, or they are referred. Sometimes we have just general plenary sessions in which we promote the opportunity, mm-hmm. make folks aware of that. And then we have special sessions such as Grace Place Wellness Retreats. And that really provides a cradle for this opportunity because they're already thinking that way, thinking about wellness. So if I just piggyback on that just a little bit, we begin talking about the proper relationship of stewardship. I think one of the things that takes place that's extremely critical is to understand that in the perfect creation, we were meant to be stewards. It wasn't sin that relegated us to be stewards. We were meant to be. So in Genesis 1:28 and Genesis 2:15, before the fall, mm-hmm. God puts them into the garden to take care of it, something to take care mm-hmm. of what is not theirs, but something that they're wholly responsible for. Mm-hmm. And because it was perfect, everything was just the way it was supposed to be. And then sin enters the picture, and all of a sudden we begin to think that we are God, that we are the owners, that mm-hmm. we are the ones that can make decisions out of all of this without considering the whole. Once we get through that aspect of it, it changes the perspective about how you address these issues of personal finance. So we're able to really get to the basics. And really the basics are just three things. And I tell folks, if you do these three things, I guarantee you that you will be successful in financial planning. And the reason is that people think financial planning is more than this. They think of retirement investment. They think of, mm-hmm. you know, accumulation. They think of asset allocation, you know, stocks, bonds, all these other kinds of elaborate things that really are secondary. So when you think about the basics, we're looking at the knowing the difference between what you own and what you owe.
Okay.
Okay. The second thing is knowing where the money comes from and where it goes. And then the third is the difference between all that you own and all that you owe.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So three things.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with you on that.
So when we start looking at it from that perspective, we help people with tools that we've developed to help them understand. You know, I misspoke on that third one. Third one really should be where the money comes from and where it goes. So I'll go through those again just to make sure that I correct myself. The first one is to know the difference between what you own and what you owe. That's the tool we use for that is a net worth statement.
Mm-hmm.
The second is where the money comes from and where it goes. That's an income statement. And then how you prioritize that spending on a regular basis is the budget. That's the document that is most difficult to understand, because when you think about budget, it's always about restrictions. It's always about I can't do this and I can't do that. But realistically, once the budget is set, then you have an opportunity to go ahead and make decisions because the guidance is already there. You've already decided that between the two of you, if you're married, about what those expenditures are going to be. And if you're not married, you've decided with yourself about how you're going to prioritize that spending. So what I mean by prioritizing that spending is that you just note it on that document. So even though you put taxes on there, that's not one of those things where everybody is really jumping through hoops and can't wait to pay. But we're citizens of the United States, and so we must participate. It also means paying for your home, paying for groceries, gasoline, all those things that someone else kind of decides for you. But once you place it on that budget, now you've said, okay, I own that. I'm going to take care of this. I'm responsible for that. And so now you start working with that budgetary process. So when we talk about becoming healthy, it's once those three are set together, and I'll repeat those because they're worth repeating. Know the difference between what you own and what you owe, where the money comes from and where it goes, and how you prioritize your spending every month.
Okay.
Those are really the three. Once that happens, you're going to be able to, over time, make a plan about your future, about your future finances. You're going to be able to uncover disposable income that will allow you to either concentrate on paying off your debt in a healthy way, or begin to set money aside for that retirement process or the accumulation process. All those are really liberating once you get through that process.
So working through those three steps, if you were meeting one-on-one with someone, what would you look at to figure out that just that first step alone? What are some of the things you'd look at?
Well, the first thing is to just talk with folks to find out where they are. What are their expectations? What is it that they're planning for the future? It's interesting. Sometimes I talk with folks and they'll say, when I retire, my wife and I want to travel. And that's the first time she's heard about that. It's a really interesting interaction that takes place when that revelation is made. Things like, I don't want to travel with you every day.
Do you see that, Mark, when visiting with folks, that sometimes retirement plans between spouses are different?
Well, as you mentioned, communication's a big part of it, whether it's, you know, with anything, but with finances especially, it's a big deal, and getting ready for retirement and what you're going to be in retirement and where you're going to be and those sorts of things. You know, it can't be, if you're married, you cannot make those decisions in a silo, as Ostolio.
I like to tell folks that, you know, the gifts that God has given to you are there for life. He's not waiting to get a memo from Concordia Plans that says, this guy is retired, to turn him off. They're there for life. And so if you've been in the pastorate all of your life, there are other aspects of that you may be able to participate in. If you've been an educator all of your life, there are certainly other opportunities. If you've been an administrator all of your life, whatever it is, there are still other opportunities for you to take part in. But if you haven't prepared yourself for that eventuality, for that time in your life, then you're kind of restricted. You know, Paul says that what we need to do is to be ready for every opportunity that the Lord places before us. And so, you know, we think, oh, yay, I'm ready for retirement. Now what? And so oftentimes, for instance, in Grace Place or in pre-retirement seminars, we'll hand out a daily schedule and just says, what are you going to do all day long? It's amazing what happens. How many times they'll say, well, I wanted to play a lot of golf. Really? Let's say that you're really bad and it takes you 5 hours. How many hours are there in the day? What else are you going to do? What else are you going to do with these gifts that you've been given? And so it's kind of a revelation mm-hmm. because people aren't really realistically looking at their retirement. They're in love with the idea of retirement, mm-hmm. but now what that means for their living mm-hmm. and what that could mean for as in terms of their responsibilities of being stewards of their gifts and preparing for another aspect of their life and how God can use them in that. I had one fellow who talked about being a deep sea scuba diver instructor. And I was, okay, I guess I've never heard that, Pastor. And I talked with him about 5 years later. And sure enough, that's what he was doing. But in that group of people that he was instructing, he was creating opportunities for Bible studies and opportunities for people to know who Jesus is. Because mm-hmm. ultimately, that's the only reason we exist. Mm-hmm. And so he was sharing that with them, but because he had done all of his preparation, he was free mm-hmm. to be able to participate in that event, mm-hmm. in those events, sure. those opportunities, freely, without worrying about these other issues. Mm-hmm. So he knew his retirement plan was there. He knew that his Social Security was going to be where it needed to be. He had accumulated some other funds, and he had reduced all of his extra spending, unnecessary spending, and so he was able to focus in on that. He was so happy and so joyful, and I was too, knowing that here the gospel message is being considered, and maybe four or five different people every year that he teaches how to deep sea dive.
And that's I'm sure quite a face to face opportunity where you get to know someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stelio, earlier you mentioned that. You know, having a budget is often viewed as being very limiting, but you have indicated that really it's freeing. Mm-hmm. And you just spoke again about this person who was free. Mm-hmm. So how do you really get there? Let's say you're sitting down with a couple, you're looking at, you know, there's more money going out than is coming in. What now?
Well, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to take what's called a 6 month cash flow summary, and they put all of their expenditures in there over the last 6 months, and then they take an average. In the past, there have been times when, for instance, car insurance could be paid annually, and if you can't forget about that. Mm-hmm. You have to average that and include that in sure. there. And so every month, a part of your income is going to be set aside for those kinds of expenditures. But if you take the average, it sort of gives you a jumping off point for your first budget, because you just take those averages and put it into the budget profile. And the budget itself has a column that I'm talking about. It's called amount agreed to spend, and that's simply another word for the term budget. And so when I ask who's responsible for that, it's obvious not me and the participant, but it's the participant and their spouse. Mm-hmm. So you outline that. And then you review that at the beginning of the month. You discuss those expenditures, and then you have an agreement. At the end of the month, you come together and you review what you actually spent. And then you just compare those two to make sure that you're within those parameters. If you are truly in agreement, What that means is now you are free now to make those expenditures without having to worry about the decision, because the decision was made jointly.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question is, can I make a choice to spend money outside of that budget? And so the question or the answer has to be no, not without the ratification of the other person that's responsible for that budget. Mm-hmm. So when you discuss that, you can say, okay, we're going to change our budget. It's not in stone. But the two of you have to communicate, mm-hmm. agree. And once you've got, because it doesn't, you can't make an accurate budget the first time. You begin working on that process. And let's say time has gone by, and now a couple is fairly certain about where those expenditures are being made, how that prioritization is made. The next step is for them to say, what can we spend less on to free more money for debt mm-hmm. reduction, for future retirement? How can we help find money in our budget to obviate risk? For instance, they may need life insurance. They may need, you know, more car insurance. They may need protection for the future. So those things come only by reducing the expenditures, because you only have a finite amount of income. So I'll go back to the income statement that says, you know, where the money comes from, where it goes. And I like to ask people whether or not they could spend more than they earn. And inevitably, folks will say, yes, you can. And I say, no, you can't. You can buy more than you earn by using these little plastic things. Mm-hmm. And so what you're doing is increasing the amount of credit card debt or delaying the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Just understanding those kinds of very simple, basic kinds of tools, I think, is what helps folks to really come to grips with the reality of their finances. It's none of this is a perfect system, because we have all of our perspectives and hidden agendas in mind. But after a while, communication breaks those down so that you can mm-hmm. become healthy. And then after a while, quite honestly, you've been doing this for a long time. Sometimes you don't even need a written budget anymore. It's in your head.
Yeah,
it's in your heart.
Yeah.
Your head and heart. And so that's a good way.
With just, our time has gone so quickly, with just about a minute left, a minute for each of you here. Ultimately, going through financial education like this, what is the end goal for you as someone educating others on being financially fit?
The end goal is to make them responsible for what their actions are, change behavior when it's necessary, but to understand that this is a tool that God has given them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like everything else, we don't handle it perfectly. But we need to address the issues, be honest about it, and ask that the Lord would provide for that kind of strength, because that's the only place that you're going to get enough strength to be able to handle finances, whether it's good, bad, or great.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Mark?
Well, especially working with church workers, if the financial part of their lives is causing a lot of stress, then they will not be serving mm-hmm. as well as they could be serving in their location. And so it's really important that they are able to get that under control so that the stress is, you know, relieved and they're able to better serve. Ultimately, then they're also going to be better prepared for retirement when they get there. And, you know, you want people that are working because they want to continue to work and not because they have to have a check mm-hmm. in order to make it by. You want them to continue in the workforce because they want to be there
mm-hmm.
And then retire, you know, on their time and when they're ready.
Well, thank you both for being here today, for sharing with us. It sounds like we have more to talk about down the road.
We're here at your disposal.
Happy to do it.
Thank you both for sharing with us and educating me and certainly our listeners as well. Eustolio Gomez with Concordia Plan Services, Director of Worker Resources. Thanks for being my guest today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Mark Borchardt, Director of Retirement Products and Services with Concordia Plan Services. Thank you so much for being my guest
thank
today.
Thank you.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program.
Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.